Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
And we're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It is the last episode for the spring season here at Heritage Radio Network, and we're coming back in May 6th, so not a very long break, but I think it's fitting that we're going to be talking about a cookbook that has a more reflective tone. It is part armchair foodie philosophy, part cookbook, and 100% Tamar Adler. It is Something Old, Something New, and we're joined in the studio with Tamar. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining, and welcome back. It's been a while since we had you on the station for An Everlasting Meal. Was that 5 years ago?
I think it was 7 years ago. It took me a really long time to write another book.
Yeah. Well, this one took a lot of digging. So, you know, this book is about old recipes revisited. Actually, that is... Classic Recipes Revisited is the subtitle. So let's talk about old recipes, old cookbooks. This is something that like fascinates people. I'm a huge fan of old cookbooks. And, you know, a few weeks ago we had an author on the show who tried to cook her way through everything that Benjamin Franklin ate.
Heavens.
Yeah, it was fun. And, you know, I don't know anyone who isn't just fascinated by an old cookbook that they might see at a junk shop. And, you know, there's like a vintage cookbook store, shout out to Bonnie Slotnick, that you can spend hours in just flipping through and flipping through. So it sounds like you did a lot of that for this book.
I did. And I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you, I'm completely intrigued by them. And I think I could spend, I could go on doing versions of this probably forever just because I don't know exactly what we look through old cookbooks for, but I know we must never exactly find it because we keep on reading them, and it's so delightful.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you, as someone who gets a kick out of this, what is the allure of old cookbooks? Is it funny? Is it like, oh, ha-ha, look at those loaves of ham?
That's never been what it does for me.
Okay.
And I wrote about the Betty Crocker recipe box, which was... A box of recipes that was kind of given to young housewives in the 70s for the New York Times Magazine. And so many people who were interested in those recipes now, you know, I wrote it a couple of years ago, were interested in the kind of kitsch appeal. And that's never what it is for me. I actually see so much beauty. And I think there's so much information about people's lives. Mm-hmm. And about the way we socialized and about our values. And I also, for me, more often than not, there's something of real lasting culinary value, mm-hmm. In recipes. And sort of the weirder they are and the harder they are to really see something delicious in, the more important it is to me to spend time with them and find that thing. Because like with the Betty Crocker recipes, you know, it was, they look so ridiculous to us now. They were for like all those loaves that you were just talking about, that it would be really easy to just kind of laugh at them and throw the whole box out the window. But there's often something, definitely not in every recipe, but in all the recipes in this book, there is something. And in a lot of recipes that I didn't even get to include, there's something wonderful that is easy to lose when, you know, times change and fashions change.
Right. You kind of stole my next question, like out of your just words were just so exacting. But, you know, are we missing out on some wisdom that may have been forgotten throughout the times? Or is it more just a matter of fashion?
I think both. I mean, I think the part of the reason that so many of us love old cookbooks and old recipes is because there is so much there. There is culinary wisdom. There is information about the similarities between life now and life then. There is some aesthetic difference, you know, and that can be so exciting. Like the frictive nature of different styles, aesthetic differences, is so wonderful. I think it's a really pleasurable thing. It's why we go to vintage shops. It's why we buy, you know, chipped ceramics when we could buy new ceramics. Because there's something wonderful about having something from a different time. And I think there's also something really pleasurable in dealing with any matter or material that's been used. You know, knowing that other...
Splatters on the pages.
Yeah, splatters on the pages. You know, thinking about who...
Fights between cooks that happened as they were cooking.
Yeah, yeah. Family lore. I mean, there's everything. And there's this... There's a professor at... I forget what university that also writes under the pen name Aranti Cherm. And I quote him in, I think, the introduction to that book, talking about... what's so wonderful about reading old cooking terminology. And what's so wonderful about it, he puts it perfectly, and so I'm just going to quote him again. But is that it's a poetry of lost specifics. And I don't think there's any more precise way of saying that, you know, you when you read old recipes and you read techniques that simply don't need to be used anymore, we don't need to singe and draw our meat. It comes that way.
Right.
You might not even know what it means.
No. You know, but essentially, we don't need to do it because I'm not singeing and drawing.
But when you read them, you realize it's a vernacular. It's a culinary vernacular that is somewhere underneath all of the culinary processes that we now partake in.
So it's just a change of choice of words.
Well, no, it's more than that because we, right now, I mean, singeing means, is, you know, the process of passing flame over the skin of an animal to get rid of feathers or hair. That's still done.
Yeah.
But it's done in a different place. It isn't done in the home. We can buy our meat cut up so we don't have to do the breaking it into quarters and taking out the entrails and all that. So it refers to stuff that doesn't actually have to happen in the home sphere anymore. But so it's so wonderful, you know, because it happens in generally in processing facilities. Like that's where your meat gets all these things that you used to have to do at home. It's so neat to realize that there are processes that are no longer part of the daily cook's job, but that were part of getting food on our table. And there's a whole language attached to it.
Gosh, we are so lazy now. We have it so easy.
We do have it easy. And I mean, in the future, I bet some of the stuff in this cookbook.
I bet their 30-minute meals is more like 3-hour meals.
Yeah, cooking, like, right. There was some pre-Rachel Ray and pre-I don't know whomever, and the whatever the precursor of, you know, television or radio or whatever it was, sitting around a fire being like, here, you can cook this for, you know, in 6 hours or less.
I got the formula.
Yeah.
Yeah. You seem to relish the prose of the old cookbooks, too.
I love it.
You mentioned just a few seconds ago, and you mentioned in this book, you know, something like, there's no better way of saying it than so-and-so. You mentioned Marion Harland in this context a couple times. In the beginning, you write, there's no better answer to how to find a good radish than what she said in her 1871 Common Sense Cookery. Good radishes are crisp to the teeth, look cool, and taste hot.
I mean, what's better than
that? That's sassy. That's a really good copy.
It's sassy and it's perfect.
I know.
I mean, a part of what when I first thought about this book, what I wanted to do, and I'm glad I didn't do, but what I had originally wanted to do was literally just string together old recipes that I thought were beautiful. Mm-hmm. Somehow finding a way after each one or before each one to explain what was so great about it. But I think that would not be a super useful book.
Yeah.
Or so did my publisher didn't think so either. But sometimes, you know, what you find in old books of any kind, but certainly in old cookbooks, is that something has already been written absolutely perfectly. And
right.
The rest of us who are, you know, trying to find another way to describe a good radish is a fool's errand. She got it right. Marion Harland nailed it. And she did it, I think, wasn't she also the writer of the oyster roast?
Yes, I was just going to point that out. This is a beautiful passage that you bring out from Marion about roast oysters. She said, there is no pleasanter frolic for an autumn evening in the regions where oysters are plentiful than an impromptu roast in the kitchen. And it goes on, and it's awesome. It is gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. And she has, fireside clicks. And,
shucking sounds.
Yeah, the sounds of the, you know, you picture people sitting around the fire, and the oysters obviously pop open mostly on their own, but you keep a couple of oyster knives around just to, make sure they get thoroughly open. And it's so evocative.
Mm-hmm.
And her prose is absolutely gorgeous.
So does this make you want to, as a food writer, just throw in the towel and be like, okay, forget it. I can't add to this.
It made me want to do that enough that I did originally suggest just stringing together old text. But the truth is that M.F.K. Fisher did that. She did string together old text.
So many people wrote about oysters, too.
So many people wrote about oysters, yeah. She has a book called Here Let Us Feast.
Mm-hmm.
That's just her favorite food passages from throughout literary history. And it is, I think, the only book of hers that I really think is bad.
Mm.
It's not Here, fun to read.
Okay.
Yeah. it's not fun to read. And I think it's because you really need a voice that is contemporary to yours.
Got it.
Speaking to you, I think. And I think when you do that, then you can really illuminate old passages. I think that reading Marion Harland, I hope reading Marion Harland in Something Old, Something New, in my book, is so pleasant and enjoyable because the rest, it's not all, you know, pleasant
these
or
voices,
frolics and fireside clicks. Some of it is just a normal person talking.
Right. And you bring this into a modern day context by looking back on it, reflecting on it, what's relevant and why it's, you know, why it's still so, you know, important today to read this.
Yeah. And whenever I do quote an old recipe directly, I then update the recipe directly after it. So I, you know, there were no measurements in her recipe. So I wrote my own that produces the exact same thing, but it tells you how much butter to use and how much chili sauce to use.
And you share your own fireside clicks, if you will. your own cooking patterns and your own opinions throughout this book, which are different a little bit, as you mentioned in the beginning, from a which is personal to you. You like to simplify things often.
I'm really lazy.
Yes.
I wrote that at the beginning of this book. And it's just true. I used to be a professional cook for years. But even then, I think I was a little bit lazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's laziness in the kitchen more than in other parts of my life. But I just can't quite bear the really painstaking stuff that I think you have to want to do, either to make classic recipes as they were or to work in fine dining kitchens, I don't have the patience for.
Well, your laziness is a boon to everyone else's practicality.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, it's very helpful to know the most direct, efficient way to do something well still.
Yeah.
that still, you know, satisfied you. By the way, who is Marion Harlan? Why don't we know these people?
I don't know why we don't know them. I think I do.
Common I've never sense heard cookery. Of that.
She was a housewife. You know, there were a lot in the 1800s. There were a lot of these housewifery books being published. They were very popular. Women's magazines, you know, it did already exist, and it was kind of how women got their information about how to run a household. The ones I love in particular are the ones that have a kind of frugal bent, because in addition to being lazy, I am parsimonious. I mean, I save everything. I do not love luxury or excess in the kitchen. You know,
that seems like traits that other people in the past would use. I mean, they had this larder, they'd save their fat.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
And they did it all the time.
You know, those ones, The Frugal Housewife by Lydia Marie Child, I think, and Common Sense Cookery by Marion Harlan, are just absolutely gorgeous and appeal directly to my sensibilities, you know, how to make the most of everything and do it sort of as efficiently as possible. I think we don't know their names because cookbooks do tend to be, right, at least right now, the cookbook industry, this might always have been true, is a very kind of what's new, what's next, who's up, who's the most exciting, what are the flashiest photographs, just sort of what's in, what's, you know, and there's nothing to sell with old books. I don't think Common Sense Cookery has been reissued since, I don't know when.
Then
I don't know.
Who chooses and why did The Joy of Cooking by Irma something?
Romber.
Get chosen to go on forever and ever in editions, and everybody has that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of the easier answers are that the ones that certainly haven't made it predate Fannie Farmer's updating of the recipe format. It was really the Boston Cooking School and Fannie Farmer that codified the way recipes were written. And a lot of the ones that I love are really hard to follow. I mean, that's why I don't put any of them in this book or anywhere without putting them through a pretty rigorous process of,
figuring
reformatting
out what they're talking about,
and making sure that it makes sense to people now. They're only fun to read if you like the prose and if you want to go on a little kind of detective mission. Because so I think that some of the ones that have survived have certainly been postdated. You know, the formalization of a common recipe style.
And stream of conscious recipe style was more like
I think also that you know, the Rombauer Becker family did a really good job of continuing to work on on joy and having it
be the one.
I
want to hear a lot more about some of these old authors and old recipes right after a quick little commercial interlude.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market, whatever makes you whole.
All right, we're back chatting more with Tamar Adler, whose latest book is Something Old, Something New. And we were just talking about something old in the way of recipe and cookbook authors. So who else really fascinated you on this journey? And first of all, actually, what is like the method behind finding these cookbooks?
It was less method than kind of mania.
Like madness.
Yeah. I think I would have loved to have developed a method. Mm-hmm. I love old cookbooks and old menus so much that I found myself, you know, I was a scholar in residence at New York Public Library, which is they have a wonderful program where if you have a book contract, you can go and use a private room there and keep as many books as you can fit on a shelf. And so I would literally just sit at like their main bank of computers and, you know, I would have a running list of cookbooks I had read mention of somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'd find those cookbooks but they would then branch out to other ones, you know, or I would look up something like pâté or like loaf and just literally collect.
That's a good way to find them.
Hundreds of those of titles and write them all in the little slips, submit them by the huge batch and get the books and collect them on my shelf and go through them and do that for days on end. And then I also went to the University of Pennsylvania has a great library. Mm-hmm. They have a rare books room that has and they have a great culinary collection.
That's great.
And so I would just show up in the morning there and look things over. And I mean, I was a horrible record keeper. So I would like take photos, but then lose the photos on a certain phone and then find them on an old computer and then try to write it down. And I mean, it was just sort of a mess, but it was mostly just branching interest.
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, like for a scholarly paper, maybe that would be a little problematic, but for something that is like going to highlight what's most evocative to you, what you remember most is what,
I had, the original proposal for the book was a very time-limited survey. It was supposed to be from like 1940 to 1980. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I started, it was evident to me that I was not going to write the book that I had sold. Instead, I was going to write a book that was just a revision of recipes that were interesting to me.
Yeah.
And actually part of what was really challenging about writing this book is that I hope it's not at all evident to a reader, but they're not tied together by anything at all other than my interest.
Mm.
There's no time frame. There's no
cuisine. Is it like mostly French or?
It ends up being mostly French, British, American.
Uh-huh.
And that's because the books that I was reading were in English, and you know, culinary insularity was the norm until very recently. And certainly if you look at like the history of, you know, Chinese immigrants in America and, you know, it was horribly, horribly contentious and dramatic through the 19th century. So like when I'm writing about, you know, recipes from the 1800s, I think, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act is probably coincidental with a lot of the recipes that I'm writing about. We're the only Eastern cuisine were these, you know, chow chop suey houses here. There's just no cross-pollination until pretty recently. And, you know, the globalization has changed that completely, but it's all very recent.
Yeah. So you're getting a certain point of view through
It's a very insular kind of continental European cuisine. Yeah.
So who is, tell me about this, cookbook author, who was one of the first African-American cookbook authors that you stumbled across.
Rufus Estes.
Rufus.
If all that comes of the publication of this book is that everybody starts reading Rufus Estes, I will be content.
How do we do that? Okay. So he wrote a book.
His single book is available through the University of Michigan's digital database of cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it's called, but if you were to look up University of Michigan cookbook database, it's on there. It's called Good Things to Eat as Recommended by Rufus, I think. And it was published in 1911.
Uh-huh.
It was reissued in the 90s or the aughts. So you can get that one.
Okay.
And, I mean, Bonnie Slotnick might have it. Amazon might have it. But it's with a the subtitle's wrong, and I resent the subtitle.
Oh.
So I haven't gotten it.
So it's not the original, exactly.
It's not the original, because his subtitle is fantastic. Good Things to Eat is recommended by Rufus, or by Rufus Estes. It's obviously a great and descriptive title. And it was changed in the second edition, which came out, 100 years later,
right,
to Good Things to Eat. The recipes by the first African-American railway chef, or first black chef, or just something that...
Told you a little bit about him.
Well, yeah, it just seems like it contextualized it in a difficult and... In a difficult context that wasn't necessarily what I think he would have wanted. I mean, he was an African-American. He was born a slave. And it was a pretty incredible thing that he went from, being born a slave to being one of the first and only private stewards on a private chefs on mm-hmm. a steward
railroad?
Was common, but yeah, okay. A private first chef on a railway car. And then he wrote this gorgeous book, and he's a beautiful writer.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's empathetic and authoritative, and I really like the way he thinks about food.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was probably a great chef, and he does something in the book that we're now seeing cookbook authors do. Which is he combines in this one book really rustic, like peasant Southern food. I mean, more like probably the food that he ate growing up, like mint vinegar and like a lot of the kind of housewife tricks that you would use to stretch ingredients and like, green tomato jam, stuff that is, really traditional Southern food tied to the seasons, tied to the harvest, very, very close to the land food.
Mm-hmm.
That's combined in the same book as really high-end, haute cuisine, French haute cuisine, which he had been trained in over his time with the Pullman Car Company. And so it's like, I think it's what a lot of Southern chefs certainly are doing now in single cookbooks, and chefs do right now. There's been a real meeting of rustic cooking and high, haute cuisine. And in a lot of fine restaurants, you find people really, Sean Brock, people doing the stuff that grandmas used to do when they had to, because they had no refrigeration, just to like keep tomatoes and keep peaches. And, and Rufus does it all in one book in 1911.
Wow. So ahead of his time.
So ahead of his time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So much to learn from these old cookbook authors.
If they ever reissue his book again, I would do anything to write an introduction to it, because I just think he's the best.
I hope that we hear a lot more about him too, and find out more about, what else he did during his life and how he got to write a cookbook. That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I would like to know that too.
How do you describe, or how do you define old? Because that's kind of subjective. Like, did you stick with like 100 years old for this book, or did it?
No, okay. I didn't. That was, I think the epigraph to the book is from the Bible, and it says, is there anything of which you can say, look, this is something new? Mm. It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. I sort of think that you can... nothing is new, and probably everything is old.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some recipes that, were from the 1980s that I still felt a need to include and do a little updating to, because they were published in the 1980s, but there were four foods that were eaten long before that. And the 1980s was probably the most recent that, that they were around. But they actually were from... the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
we kind of went on serving some version of them. So I would look at the most recent iteration,
mm-hmm.
and even that clearly needed mm-hmm. updating.
Well, I'm just fascinated by how many of these recipes from another era, as interpreted by other cooks, are still being eaten commonly, deviled eggs.
Well, they're one of the few that I think has really survived as it was.
All right. Yeah. I know, right?
Yeah.
It's a dated food, but we still enjoy it. Like, just, we don't think of it as like an antique or something like that. You have an older recipe, which I didn't realize, you know, people are making egg drop soup from an old, you know, I think it's not from a Chinese cookbook. It's like an American cookbook that included this recipe for egg drop soup.
Well, that's just my recipe, but I included it because I wanted to include the fact that there was a fixation with, I mean, almost an obsession with Chinese cuisine and Chinese technique. Certainly, that started with the chop suey houses,
right?
But slowly grew, especially after the end of the Chinese Exclusion Act. Certainly, after Nixon went to China, you know, suddenly you see people hiring Chinese chefs,
making
woks and stir frying become chic, steaming vegetables become chic, and then, you know, then egg drop soup is like this wonderful exotic thing. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to include it because I do feel like there's something about that book that's a kind of rough culinary history of what has happened in the U.S. For the last 150 years or so. And I thought it was important to include this kind of culinary artifact that actually, I mean, it's a pantry soup. It's very much like stracciatella, the Italian version, which are just made with egg noodles. Same thing. I mean, noodles made of egg. You just put eggs through a fork and they kind of become these shreddy noodles inside your soup.
Oh, it's the same exact thing then.
Yes.
Okay. I love that, you know, there's all these like fashions too. You mentioned that zucchini was fashionable and chic back in, I don't know, the 50s
the 60s,
or so. 60s and 50s. And now it's kind of like a boring ingredient, and other ingredients are more in fashion. So there's just, oh my goodness, it's about all the time we have for today. I did want to ask, though, that once we're on the topic of eggs, that, you know, if you felt that... You're going to, like, hate me for this question.
Oh, no.
I'm going to talk about the egg spoon for a second. What you mentioned in your Grub Street diary is something, an utensil that was used to cook an egg on an open fire. This isn't, like, an old utensil, though, is it? It's just a new... it's a griddle.
We were given a handmade egg spoon as a wedding present. It was made by somebody in Vermont. Mm-hmm. I think it costs like $50. They just made it in their home in a forge. You know, they're like a Vermont artisan. And before that, we used this Jaffel iron, mostly because we have a wood stove and my husband's parents have a wood stove and they've always cooked eggs in a Jaffel iron. But I'm sure that, many utensils were made out of iron with very long handles so that they could be held in a fire. So in that respect, it's a very old thing. It became, it sort of like showed up again because Angelo Garo, a wonderful blacksmith in California, in San Francisco, made one for Alice Waters.
Right.
She cooked with it on 60 Minutes. People found it very
controversial,
off-putting, elitist. Recently, it has been mentioned, and I agree that a lot of the criticism actually has to do with it being a woman who did it rather than a man. So I drew a lot of fire when I, in my Grub Street diet, admitted that I, too, even though it made everybody so angry when Alice did it, that I also have an egg spoon and I love it. And it's, people's getting so angry about that was funny because it, for lots of reasons. First of all, it seemed like a terrible waste of energy on their parts, but also because even in my Grub Street diet, I pointed out that I understood that it was going to, you know, make people cringe.
You're
but the fact
like,
is, they're like, I heat this whole space with a wood stove, which means that it's a perfect place to cook anything.
I think it was like this whole controversy was really taken out of context in a lot of ways.
It has been generally misquoted and every time it gets written about again. I mean, Kim Severson did not misquote anything. She got everything right. But generally, every iteration of the storytelling gets some of it wrong. It's also not a story. I mean, I don't know why anybody would bother.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate that we're talking even about this, but I just thought it'd be worthwhile to mention because it's, you know, it's a cooking apparatus.
It's a cooking utensil. And my friend Samin was quoted in the Kim Severson New York Times piece as saying, you know, nobody blinks an eye when a male chef uses some preposterous ingredient, some preposterous apparatus to cook some basic ingredient in some weirdo way.
Right.
And like when Dave Chang started making his 12-hour eggs in an immersion circulator, everybody was like, oh my God, he's the man.
Right.
And then like when I'm like, I had a fire going, so I cooked an egg in it, you know, people start flipping out and calling me names. And I think that has more to do with my lack of penis than it does mm-hmm. with my egg spoon.
Yeah. And, you know, as this book and many others attest, there are so many ways to cook an egg.
There are so many ways to cook an egg.
You should write a book about that next. Although, your next book is about how many ways to cook a chicken.
Chicken leftovers.
Leftovers.
Yeah.
Well, true.
Yes. No, yes. You're right. It is. Exactly.
I'm
it
really
is how many ways to cook
to
a
that.
Chicken. Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry. We ran out of time for today.
That's great.
Really, really appreciate hearing your thoughts on all things old, all things new. And I hope everyone gets their hands on this book. There's so much more to discover in it. So thank you so much, Tamar.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. And thanks, everyone at Heritage Radio. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.